Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Been a fairly hectic day and indeed week here, so tonight's is a bit of a shunt together show. It's always interesting to see where they go. I have it in mind to play a couple of wee pods about why we shouldn't talk to the police. That's because over the last several weeks we've spent a lot of time listening to people who've one way or the other been talking to the police. We heard Truth Juice Dave talking about his electricity supply challenges. We also heard him talking about how he decided to take on the Welsh police with regard to an alleged travelling offence. I think he was supposedly travelling a few miles an hour over the speed limit and decided that he'd go and play a game on the court over that one. We heard from Guy Taylor, who also, of course, has had to be talking to authority because they're busy writing out loans on his behalf and nicking property and accusing him of removing things from them that he hasn't actually demonstrably removed and all of that. We heard also from Danny, of course, and his dad seeing off a couple of peace officers and a man from Capita and a man from the TV licensing, all of them one way or the other, and choosing or obliged to engage with the representatives of the world management team. So by way of balance, like I say, I thought we'd have a look tonight at why it is that we might consider not talking to the police. Later on also, there'll be a bit of a look into why it is that after all the work we've done and all of the things we've found, why it is that some people just won't believe a word we say to them. That's broadly in relation to 9/11, but it's some very interesting chat from psychologists as to just exactly what forces are being used to kind of encourage us to behave us in the way we are and just exactly what effect that has on our behaviour. Later still in the show, if there is still time, which I'm sure there will be, I'll be reading another bit of ET101, the Cosmic Instruction Manual for Planetary Evolution. The introductory bits of which were read a long, long time ago on the Dr. Rock Show, never made it into a podcast, but don't worry, it's easy to catch up. Before getting into the not talking to the police, I want to play one more tune whilst things cool down here a little bit, check that the levels are all alright, and then I'll be back with you. Thanks as ever to all of you for being out there. I really do enjoy my Thursday nights. Well, I want to start the talky bit of tonight's show with a podcast that I got off YouTube a long time ago. Actually, that little chirrup there reminds me, for some reason my computer has started chirruping away. I've been trying to find out where the noises are coming from and to turn them off. I don't know why it started. It hasn't done it for weeks now. And also it keeps asking me if I want to restart it now or later. So if at any point I miss that button, it may well be once again that I vanish for a while. Still, I'll try and keep my eye on it. This download from YouTube is something that many of you might have seen when it first came out a while back, might not have had a chance to look at it again recently, and it's called broadly Why We Shouldn't Talk to the Police Under Any Circumstances. I'll put a link for it into the chat box when I get it started. It's a character called Professor Duane, who's some kind of attorney, and the second half of it, which has been separated a little bit for the purposes of the show, is a chap called Officer George Brooke. The first man spends some time and, most amusingly, in my opinion, gives loads of reasons in American terms for why the police should not be approached. But as we know, the rules over there broadly apply over here as well. And you can be pretty certain that what he says is as true for us as it is for them. I've got a few thoughts to add of my own in between the various bits. Officer Brooke himself reveals some of the techniques that are used, which are themselves, if you didn't know what we already know, quite shocking. But I think this material is worthy of review, partly, like I say, because it's very entertaining, partly because it's coming from somebody who obviously knows what it's talking about, and partly because it probably is, personally, the most important lesson that I've taken on board whilst listening to TNS. Many regular listeners, or certainly people who are around at the beginning, will know that I had a bit of difficulty with this concept myself one way or the other, and that I'm a man who likes to chat, and I don't really mind who I chat to, and it took a while to realise that this was possibly not the best approach. So here we go. This is Professor Duane talking about not talking about, not talking to the police. It's about half an hour long or so. I'll be back with you after this.
I was invited to give you a taste of a typical law school classroom experience here today, and I thought I would take advantage of this opportunity to do something that's been on my mind for a while. To stand up and to proudly say, God bless America, God bless the Bill of Rights, and thank God for the Fifth Amendment. I'm not ashamed to say I'm proud of the Fifth Amendment, and I'm proud to admit on camera and on the internet that I will never talk to any police officer under any circumstances, with all due respect, sir. I'm doing something really extraordinary here today, something you'll almost never see another law professor do as long as you live. I'm really putting myself on the spot here. This was my idea. By my invitation, I have given up half of my time, approximately. I'm giving equal time and the last word to an expert who really knows something about what I'll be talking about. So I'm opening myself up to the possibility that he will contradict me. I was a criminal defense attorney when I was in private practice. So I want to make sure, in fairness to you, if I'm misleading you or giving you a slanted or one-sided presentation, you'll be able to get the last word from somebody else. I'm sure he'll have a lot to teach all of us, including myself. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution provides, no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. And this unfortunate amendment has gotten a bad rap in recent times, much of it tragically and unnecessarily through, as you may have heard, the headlines. There was a recent Regent Law School graduate who was in all the news for a couple of weeks. She was an outstanding former student of mine, and she really got quite a lot of undeserved flack for the fact that she chose to exercise her right to remain silent when the Senate wanted to ask her certain questions that arguably might have tended to incriminate her. All of the world was aghast. The Christian community in particular looked at this and said, how could a Christian do such a thing? How could a Christian take the Fifth Amendment? And I said, you go, girlfriend. I do the same thing. I'll do it every time. And I want to talk to you about why that's true, but first a quick listening test. Let me read you something that was taken out of the newspaper this morning, and I want you to listen to it closely. And I'm giving you a heads up. I'm warning you in advance, which is not fair to you. Not fair to me, but I'm giving you a warning that I'll be quizzing you on this in just a few minutes. This will test your aptitude for legal study and legal practice. Listen closely. It won't take long. Last night, agents of the Norfolk Police Department found three victims of an apparent murder dead in an apartment in the East Ocean View area, the apparent victims of a gangland-style slaying, and possibly the victims of gang-related violence. The police are investigating this as a possible murder and suicide, but right now suspect that the three were all killed by the same individual. No suspects have yet been identified in the slaying, but veteran police detective George Brook has confirmed that police are following up on evidence pointing to the possible involvement of an off-duty naval officer as the perpetrator. The bodies, which were found by the apartment manager at about 8 o'clock in the morning, appear to have been slain sometime earlier in the same evening, probably sometime between midnight and 2 o'clock in the morning. That's it. Those are all the facts I'll ask you to remember, and it won't be for very long either. Let's see how well you do. I'll be quizzing you in just a few minutes. Now, here's the easiest question you'll ever get from a client in all the days of your life. Question, hey, the police are here. They want to talk to me. What should I do? Well, I could give you my answer to that question in case you haven't already guessed it, but why don't we go to a real expert? Justice Robert Jackson, a prosecutor's prosecutor. Like me, he began his private practice in Buffalo, New York, years before I did, and after that he served as general counsel for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, the U.S. Department of Treasury, the Security and Exchange Commission, assistant U.S. Attorney General for the Tax Division, later the Solicitor General and the Attorney General of the United States, and then the chief U.S. prosecutor for the Nuremberg trials. That's an impressive resume. Years later, when he was a justice on the Supreme Court, Justice Jackson stated, quote, any lawyer worth his salt, today we would say his or her, will tell the suspect, his client, in no uncertain terms to make no statement to the police under any circumstances. There's the title of my talk. I'm here to explain to you the surprising and somewhat counterintuitive and admittedly unlikely reasons why Justice Jackson was right. I'm reminded of this because I'm amazed, we're all amazed, by the frequency with which we see newspaper articles coming out all the time from people who really ought to know better, who say, well, I'll talk to the police. I mean, after all, I'm a senator. I'm O.J. Simpson. I'm an experienced, highly polished individual. I've got a lot of experience with public relations, even criminal defense attorneys. There was a local news story here in the Virginia Pilot just a couple of months ago about an experienced criminal defense lawyer who ended up getting convicted of criminal assault because he talked to the police. He was accused of having assaulted another attorney in the hallway. There were no other witnesses to this. A woman said that he grabbed her by the throat during an argument over a case. He denied it. At trial, it was his word against hers. He said, I did not even touch her. But unfortunately for him, when the police had approached him earlier and said, would you be willing to answer some questions? He said, sure, why not? I'm an attorney. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm savvy. I'm sophisticated. I've got oratorical prowess. I'm accustomed to dealing with the police, by all means. And then there was a conversation that was not recorded. When the case went to trial, it was no longer his word against hers, because when he testified at trial, I never touched her. The officer took her to the stand and testified, well, when I met with him, he said he did put his hand on her throat, but just as a joke. Then he had to take the stand again and say, that's not true. I never said that. I never admitted to you that I... Now it's his word against two people. Who's telling the truth? We'll never know for sure. But he was found guilty. Now, here's part of the problem. The heart of the problem, as Justice Breyer on the U.S. Supreme Court explained in 1998, is, quote, the complexity of modern federal criminal law codified in several thousand sections of the United States Code and the virtually infinite variety of factual circumstances that might trigger an investigation into a possible violation of the law make it difficult for anyone to know in advance just when a particular set of statements might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. One expert on criminal law recently noted that estimates of the current size of the body of federal criminal law vary, although it has been reported that the Congressional Research Service can no longer even count the current number of federal crimes. That's right. Even the federal government has lost count. These laws are scattered over all 50 pages of the U.S. Code, encompassing roughly 27,000 pages. Worse yet, these statutes often incorporate by reference to the provisions of administrative regulations. Estimates of how many such regulations exist are even less well settled, although the ABA thinks there may be nearly 10,000. Here's one of those 10,000 federal criminal statutes on the book that you probably never heard about. It's called the Lacey Act. 16 U.S.C. Section 3370 says it's a federal offense for any person to import, export, transport, sell, receive, acquire, or purchase any fish or wildlife or plant taken, possessed, transported, or sold in the violation of any law, treaty, or regulation of the United States or any Indian tribal law or any state or any foreign law. People have been convicted in federal court for violating this statute because they brought back a bony fish from Honduras, not knowing that Honduran law, not American, but Honduran law, forbade the possession of the bony fish. People have been convicted under the List law because they were found in possession of what's called a short lobster, a lobster that's under a certain size. Some states forbid you from possessing a lobster if he's under a certain length. It doesn't matter if he's dead or alive. It doesn't matter if you killed it or if he died of natural causes. It doesn't even matter if you acted in self-defense. Did you know that? Did you know it can be a federal offense to be in possession of a lobster? Admit it. Raise your hand if you did not know that. There's the problem. And that's only one of 10,000 different ways. You know, the government gets pretty upset when people like me instruct the client, people like me and Justice Jackson, don't talk to the police, don't answer any questions. But, you know, they can't have it both ways. You people, you've got 10,000 different ways of convicting us. Good for you. But, you know, with the bitter comes to the sweet, with the good comes to the bad. That's 10,000 different ways my client might unknowingly implicate himself in some sort of a criminal transaction. One of the reasons I decided to give this talk, I recently received a phone call from a former student of mine, a regional law school graduate, who may be watching this online. We're putting it on the internet. And he told me, hey, I've been approached by the Internal Revenue Service. They want to ask me a couple of questions. They ask if I'd be willing to. But they say that I'm not a suspect, and I know in my heart I don't think I've done anything wrong in violation of the Internal Revenue Service provisions. Lord have mercy. There's no man on earth, there's no woman in this country who can honestly say with complete confidence, I know I have never violated any provision of the Internal Revenue Code. He said, but they say I'm not a suspect, and I know I've done nothing wrong. It's okay if I talk to him. I said, no, you tell them you will not talk to them without immunity. I explained to him why that was true, and he never heard from them again. Okay, why you should never talk to the police. Let me just spell it out for you. Let me make it plain to all of you. These are the top 10 reasons. I don't want to actually really lie to you. I don't really have 10. I don't have time for 10, but I've got time for 8, and that'll be close enough. Number one, and this really ought to be good enough. Contrary to what you laymen instinctively and naturally suppose, it cannot help. There is no way it can help you. Plenty of folks think that it can, and they're always wrong. You cannot talk your way out of getting arrested. Officer Brooke, you've interviewed thousands of criminal suspects. How many times in your experience have you approached someone, asked if you could ask them some questions because prior to the interview you had some evidence pointing to his possible guilt? And because of the extraordinary persuasiveness and eloquence with which he articulated his innocence, you said, oh, sorry, never mind. Bank call, my bad, I won't, and he talks you out of arresting him.
You know the answer to that.
Never. It never happens. I've often asked other criminal defense attorneys, in all of your experience, have you ever once had a case where you looked back in hindsight and said, thank God my client talked to the police? They laugh at me. They say, you've got to be kidding me. It cannot help you. You can't talk your way out of getting arrested. And contrary to what you might suppose if you never studied the rules of evidence, what you tell the police, even if it's exculpatory, cannot be used to help you at trial. Because it's what we call hearsay. Under the rules of evidence, specifically Rule 801 D2A, if you want to look it up, Everything you tell the police, as the saying goes, can and will be used against you, but it cannot be used for you. From time to time, I've known attorneys who tried to call to the stand a police officer and say, "Officer, would you tell the jury what my client told you, because what my client told him is actually good for my case? If you tried that at trial, the prosecutor will object to that as hearsay, and the judge will agree. The police will not be allowed, at your request, to tell the jury what your client told him, no matter how good it may be for your case. It cannot help. And that ought to be good enough reason. That ought to be reason enough to keep your mouth shut. But if you're not persuaded, let me go talk about a couple of others. Number two, obviously one of the most obvious. If your client is guilty, as many of them are, but even if he's not, even if he's innocent, he may well admit his guilt with no benefit in return. Now, of course, many of you are thinking to yourself, well, what's so wrong about that? I mean, shouldn't guilty people be confessing? Confession's good for the soul. It's good for law enforcement. It's good for the prisons. Yes, yeah, sure, all those things are true. And like the rest of you, if I or anyone close to me is ever the victim of some sort of a serious crime, I hope they get the right guy. I hope they convict him. I hope they put him away. We all feel that way. Hey, but what's the rush, friends? You don't got to admit your guilt the first time they come by to meet with you. In federal court, 86% of all defendants plead guilty at some point before trial. If your client is guilty and really ought to punish and really ought to have a go through some sort of a cleansing act of contrition and fess up and admit his guilt, there'll be plenty of time to do that. They almost always do. No need to rush, no need to tell the police something. Wait and see if perhaps your client can work out some sort of an arrangement where maybe he'll make some sort of compensation to the alleged victim, or maybe he'll be able to get some sort of a discount in his sentence. And he'll be able to he'll be treated fairly then, like everybody else who had the benefit of a good lawyer who said, please do not talk to the police. And don't forget, by the way, even if your client only admits things that the police already knew, you might think, well, what harm can it do? He says he wants to talk to the police. All he wants to do is admit that he was there. But the cops know that he was there. All right, go ahead and tell them. Well, how can it hurt? It might hurt if the police officer becomes transferred to Minnesota or deceased or injured or comatose or cannot be located by the time of trial. The case will be dismissed if there's no confession. But if your client admits two things, that confession is freely admissible against him and can be a basis for getting him convicted all by himself. Senator Larry Craig can explain all of this to you. The Innocence Project of the United States has confirmed that in more than 25% of all the cases where an innocent man was convicted and then later released from prison after he was exonerated by DNA evidence, in more than a quarter of those cases, these innocent people, people we know to be innocent, made incriminating statements, delivered outright confessions, or pled guilty. How do they do that? He'll tell us all about it, I trust. Here's a couple of famous examples. You can just ask them. You don't have to take my word for it. There on the left was Eddie Joe Lloyd. He was convicted in 1984 of the murder of a 16-year-old girl in Detroit after he wrote to police with suggestions on how to solve various recent crimes. During several interviews, police fed details of the crime to Mr. Lloyd, who was mentally ill, and they lied to him and convinced this mentally ill man that by confessing, he might help them smoke out the real killer. He later signed a confession, gave a tape-recorded statement. The jury delivered it less than 1 hour before convicting him on the basis of this confession. There was no other substantial evidence against him. The judge said, "I'd hang you if I could," but the death penalty was not available in Michigan at the time. But after almost 2 decades in prison, he was released after DNA evidence proved that this man was innocent and had falsely confessed to a crime that he did not commit. On the right is Earl Washington, who was released from prison just a few years ago here in Virginia after spending 18 years behind bars after being committed of a rape and a murder that we now know he did not commit after having been exonerated by DNA evidence. But this man, Mr. Washington, who was in fact confirmed to be mentally retarded, was able to confess to several crimes at the request of the police, some of which we know he could not have committed. That's the problem. Some of you are thinking to yourself, well, none of this concerns me because I'm not guilty of anything and I never will be and I will never represent people who do. Okay. Let's talk to you people. You innocent folks, those of you who have never committed a crime and never will, and none of your clients will either, and you wouldn't go out with a girl who did. Fine. You better not talk to the police either, okay? Because number three, we'll put the guilty behind us. Forget about them. Let's talk about innocent people. Number three, even if your client is innocent and he denies his guilt and almost entirely tells the truth, odds are good he will easily get carried away and tell some little lie or make some little mistake that will hang him. This is human nature. He gets in there. It's a stressful situation. Imagine a perfectly innocent client. The police say he's been guilty of a murder. He's totally innocent as any one of us. So he goes in there and he meets with the police. He says, "I don't know what you're talking about. I was nowhere near there. I didn't kill him. I've never killed anybody. I don't have a gun. I've never had a gun. I've never touched a gun in my life. I was nowhere near Virginia Beach that night." That last line was a lie. He went over the top. He was getting carried away. He got into this groove. He started saying all kinds of things, almost all of them true, that he knew would tend to exculpate himself. Then he got carried away and just said one thing that wasn't true, and unfortunately for him, they can prove that it wasn't true. He may be convicted on that basis alone. But let's say that's not a problem. I'll tell my client only to tell the truth. I've met with him. I know he won't lie to the police. He won't make any mistakes. Okay, that's still no guarantee you won't be getting into trouble. Because even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't say anything that is false. Now, already, mind you, we're pretty well nigh into fantasy land. The odds of this being, anybody being able to pull this off are really quite slim, no matter how innocent they may be. But just for the same, let's pretend. Let's assume he gives the police nothing but the truth, and he is totally innocent. He will always give the police some information that can be used to help convict him. Always. For example, suppose you tell this to the police. Here's what your client tells to the police in his denial of guilt. I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill Jones. I don't know who did. I wasn't anywhere near that place. I don't have a gun. I've never owned a gun in my life. I don't even know how to use a gun. Yeah, sure, I never liked the guy, but who did? I wouldn't kill him. I've never hurt anybody in my life, and I would never do such a thing. Let's suppose every word of that is true, 100% of it is true. What will the jury hear at trial? Officer Brooke, was there anything about this, your interrogation, your interview with the suspect that made you concerned that he might be the right one? Yes, there was. He confessed to me that he never liked the guy. And then the prosecutor put that up in big letters, and he'll say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it's pretty clear that we've got the right guy here. We've proven that he was in Virginia Beach that night. That's opportunity. And remember, Officer Brooke admitted that after extended questioning, he was finally able to get the defendant to admit that he never liked the guy. There's your motive. Motive plus opportunity. Wham, bam. Please. But jury's heated up. And innocent people get convicted this way sometimes. How often? Hopefully not too often, but we know what happens. The United States Supreme Court, don't take my word for this, in Ohio versus Reiner, the Supreme Court of the United States said, quote, one of the Fifth Amendment's basic functions is to protect innocent men who otherwise might be ensnared by ambiguous circumstances. Truthful responses of an innocent witness, as well as those of a wrongdoer, may provide the government with incriminating evidence from the speaker's own mouth. See, it's not just some criminal defense attorney telling you this. Even the Supreme Court says I'm right. Under the facts of that case, by the way, in Ohio versus Reiner, a child tragically was died, apparently the result of shaken baby syndrome. Question was who had shaken this baby to death. And one of the possible suspects was a babysitter who had spent some time with the child that week. The babysitter's story was, I don't know what you're talking about. I did not kill the child. I did not see it happen. I don't know who shook the baby. It was never me. I never did anything of any violent nature to the child. The Ohio State Court said, well, you've got no Fifth Amendment privilege. You, by your own admission, told the investigators that you've done nothing wrong, that you were not involved. So obviously your answers can't incriminate you. The United States Supreme Court reversed and said, well, that's not true. Even though this babysitter denies shaking the child, denies seeing the child die, denies knowing how the child died, this babysitter, by her own admission, apparently the government wanted to ask whether the babysitter might have been with the child at some point that week, during the week prior to the death. And that answer, although by itself not sufficient to convict anybody, could help convict her. That means she's got a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to answer to the question the court held, because it could be used to help convict. Ullman versus United States, which the Supreme Court said more than 50 years ago, eerily prophetic. They said too many Americans, even those who should be better advised, view this privilege as a shelter for wrongdoers. They too readily assume that those who invoke it are either guilty of crime or commit perjury in claiming the privilege. That's not true, and it never has been. But it gets worse. Can it get worse? It can. Number 5. Even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and does not tell the police anything incriminating, which, by the way, is almost impossible to pull this off. I mean, imagine talking to the police for 2, 3, 4 hours, and somebody like him can't somehow manage to extract from you something that could be used to help convict you. That'd be extraordinary. I don't think anybody's pulled it off. But even if you could pull it off, there's still a grave chance that his answers can and will be used to crucify you in a court of law if the police, no offense, don't recall his testimony with 100% accuracy. All right, now this brings us back to that pop quiz I warned you about. I told you earlier, remember, it's only been a few minutes, and you weren't up all night, and you weren't the subject of physical duress. You were in the relaxed setting of a classroom here. You were given heads up, advance notice that you would be quizzed on this. Question. We'll start with a couple of easy ones. Remember that article I read you about that? How many people did the police find shot to death last night at that Ocean View apartment that I told you about? A, 1, B, 2, C, 3, D, 4. Who says A? B. C. Get this. Get that with a camera. Move that camera around. Look how many hands we've got there for C. Okay, D. You're all wrong. Everybody who raised their hand, you are the kind of people who should never talk to the police under any circumstances for as long as you live. Why is C not the right answer, by the way? If you know, raise your hand. Yes? Excellent. I didn't say anybody was shot. I didn't say gun, bullet, shooting, firearms. Didn't use any of those words. But I don't blame you if you thought that I did. This is the way the human mind works. We hear things. We fill in details. I said gangland-style slaying. That may or may not imply something, but it doesn't mean that anybody was shot. And that's the problem. You see, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell them anything incriminating, and his statement is videotaped, his answers can be used to crucify him. You might say, wait, how can that happen? I insisted, in my insistence, I called the police and I said, look, if you want to talk to my client, you can talk to him, but only if you videotape the whole thing. I don't want there to be any debate between the two of you over what happened. Okay, we'll videotape the whole thing. If the police don't recall their questions with 100% accuracy, he'll be convicted on that statement alone. For example, suppose a man goes to the police, they say, we're investigating a possible murder, a shooting. And the guy says, quote, I don't know who killed Jones, Officer Brooke, with all due respect. It wasn't me. I've never touched or fired a gun in my life. How can that help incriminate this man? How could that possibly be used against this man to help convict him? You would think it's inconceivable. But it's as easy as pie. All the officer has to do is read this statement to the jury, and then the prosecutor says, Officer Brooke, was there anything about that statement that confused you or surprised you? Yes, there was, he says, in a moment of sinister high drama in the courtroom. And what was that? And then Officer Brooke turns to the jurors and he says, I never said anything about a shooting. I said we were investigating a murder. He was the one who brought up a gun. Then you turn to your client, and your client says, that's not true. That's not true. I remember he was the one, or one of the cops. I was with them for 3 hours. One of them in the car said something about, they said they had a witness that I was the shooter. Okay, I'll put you on the stand. And then your client testifies, no, they did tell me shooting. They mentioned it before I said anything about a gun. They brought it up first. And then the police said, that's not true. And now what? It's your word against theirs? For what? You're gambling with your client's life. And police officers can very easily make a mistake like that, just as so many of you did just a few minutes ago, about whether you recalled having heard me say something about somebody actually being shot. Police make mistakes, innocently, inadvertently, unintentionally. Any statement, no matter how exculpatory it may seem on its face, can be used to crucify you all by itself if the police are either willing to lie, not likely, or if they just have an innocent misrecollection of the details as to what they did and did not tell you before you told them what you said. All of these, by the way, all of these problems disappear if you take Justice Jackson's advice and say, thank you very much, officer, but no thanks. How about this one? Here we go. Now, here's the most surprising of all. I've saved the most surprising one for last. Let's suppose you've got the following scenario. Your client's thinking about talking to the police. He says, I've got nothing to hide. They think that I killed somebody in Virginia Beach last night. Well, this is what your client tells you in confidence. I don't know who robbed that store. It wasn't me. In fact, I've got a pretty good alibi. I wasn't even in Virginia Beach that night, last night. I was 4 hours away visiting my mother in the Outer Banks. Unfortunately, no, I did not pay for gas with a credit card. I used cash, and so I've got no witnesses that can prove I was there except my word, and of course, Mama, for what that's worth, which is nothing. So your client says, so the police want to talk to me, and I want to seem cooperative, so what I'll do is I'll tell them that I was in the Outer Banks last night. Now, there's nothing on its face incriminating about any of that. Let's assume, by the way, that you believe with all your doubt, you've given your client a polygraph exam. You've known him for years. You've been going to the same Bible study for 30 years. You know beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's telling you the truth. And he's not admitting anything. He's not admitting motive. He's not admitting opportunity. He's not admitting that he was there. How on earth could this come back to haunt us? How on earth could this come back to be used against us? Be honest. Raise your hand if you really think the answer to that question is, I can't see how it could possibly be used against me. You're afraid I'll call on you, right? I won't call on you. Well, you're wrong. You're dead wrong. You're always wrong. Everything you say, every time you talk to the police, you will regret it. You see, the problem is, here it is. This is the last point. I think it's almost, even if your client is innocent and only tells the truth and doesn't tell the police anything incriminating, and the entire interview, questions and answers are videotaped, even his truthful answers can be helped to use crucify even an innocent man if the police, through no fault of theirs, end up in the possession of any evidence, even mistaken and unreliable evidence, that anything your client told them was false, even if in fact it was true. Again, going back to this example from a moment ago. Let's suppose I go ahead and I meet with the police. I think I got nothing to hide. I tell them, I was in the Outer Banks last night, officer. How can that be used to convict me? By itself, it cannot. It cannot help at all by itself. But what if I later find out, to my horror, after I put my cards on the table, that they've got a witness, a girl that I went to high school with, an unimpeachable witness, we've never been enemies, she'd have no reason to lie. She swears she thinks she saw me in Virginia Beach last night, a couple of blocks away from that store, about an hour before it was robbed. Now, her testimony by itself isn't going to help the prosecutor. Hell, if she's all they've got, I'll get this case thrown out before trial. But if, like an idiot, I talked to the police and I told them the truth, I told them I was in the Outer Banks, and now, lo and behold, tragically, it turns out they've got a witness, a false, mistaken, confused, but sincere and credible witness, who can testify that I was here at Virginia Beach, now they're likely to get a conviction. Because what they'll do, I've just turned this cop and this woman into the government star witnesses. They'll put Officer Brooke on to testify about how my client lied to him about being in the Outer Banks, and then They'll put on this girl, this is a girl who otherwise would have not even helped their case at all, who will testify, no, that's not true. That was a lie. I saw Mr. Duane's client here in Virginia an hour before the robbery, not so far from the store. By herself, she would not have helped the government in any significant way. But what I have just done, you see, is given them the other part of the puzzle. And now I'm doomed. Just ask them. I close with this example. Here we have a couple of recent celebrity examples of why it is that even people who admit nothing always end up denying it. They always end up regretting it. On the left, we have Martha Stewart. She was the victim, the subject of an extensive government investigation that was looking into the possibility that she was guilty of violations of certain federal laws, securities laws, fraud kinds of things. They couldn't pin that on her, but they were able to get a conviction because she denied it. Talking to the police and later to some of the shareholders, she said, no, it's not true. I was not guilty. So they charged her with lying to federal investigators, and they got a conviction, and she was sentenced to 5 months in prison. Marion Jones, on the right side, another person who would still be out today if she had always taken the advice that I'm giving you now, she was asked if she had ever used steroids, a controlled substance. And instead of taking the fifth, she said, no, I never took steroids when I won those Olympic gold medals. Later on, it turned out that she was lying. She worked out a deal. She pled guilty. She admitted that she was lying. And she, over her strenuous, tear-filled objection, even though she has two young children, was just recently sentenced to prison for 6 months. The guy who sold her the steroids, the pusher, he got only 4 months. But she got 6 months because she lied to the police and said that she did not do it. You see the problem. Michael Vick, who recently pled guilty, as you know, to these charges with respect to the operation of this dog combat sort of operation at his home. At sentencing, like many other criminal defendants, even though he eventually pled guilty at sentencing, one of the reasons his sentence was a little harder than it might have otherwise been, the judge said, was because when he initially met with the police, he lied to them and said, I didn't do anything. I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. Even guilty people, but not only guilty people, will always end up regretting talking to the police. So my advice to you, Justice Jackson was right. Any sane, competent lawyer in his right mind will always tell every client under all circumstances, I don't care if you're innocent. I don't care if it's the truth. If it's the truth, great. We'll tell the jury all about it. There'll be time enough to put our cards on the table. But before we get there, I haven't seen yet what the police got. They may have mistaken and confused witnesses who will contradict even the truthful stuff that you say. We have no way to know, no way to predict whether the information that you give them, even if truthful and reliable, will end up unwittingly dispelling our demise. So keep your mouth shut. Don't answer any questions. Let's take the fifth. You'll be glad that you did. God bless America. God bless the Bill of Rights and the geniuses who bequeathed it to us. But now, in fairness, I give equal time, or what's left of equal time, to a police officer who will explain to the extent to which, if any, he agrees or disagrees with anything I've got to say. I have no idea.
Well, there you go. Quite remarkable testimony there from a prosecutor saying quite clearly what his message was, that we shouldn't talk to the police under any circumstances. I enjoy that, honestly, every time I listen to it. Also, I've been seeking out just exactly such podcasts with the intent of playing them to interested parties who have not as yet got any kind of grip as to what's going on. And that one is one that really strikes home. We also scored an accidental hit, I gather, from a bit of hearsay, but a gossip that I got from Mid Wales, where a man who's completely unaware of any of this material at all was looking to reach the Dr. Rock podcast on the subject of rhesus negative blood because he knows Jill, who was involved in the discussion. And in his attempts to get hold of this particular podcast, he accidentally pressed on the YouTube clip for which there is a link, for the Dr. Rock show, which talked to Danny about his dealings with the TV licensing people. And, this particular blacksmith watched Danny's pod half an hour or so, and it was completely new to him. And apparently, ever since he saw it, he has been phoning people up and getting them round to his little house to see this clip of people dealing with the police. And he's been introducing it to all the farmers that come into his place and everybody. So he's just kind of toppled down the rabbit hole. It'll be very interesting to see what happens to him next. But it is an example of how a well-presented YouTube clip can actually in itself just cause people suddenly to start questioning what's going on around them. Professor Duane is quite a well-known YouTube character, and you can hear why, I think. If nothing else, you get twice as many words for your download as you get from anybody else. But also he's quite clear and funny about what he's saying. before we look a little bit more about what Professor Duane was coming out with, it is of course worth pointing out that if you go browsing through the podcasts on TNS Radio, you'll come across several of them that contain the words subject matter jurisdiction. And in terms of talking to the police or not talking to the police, that is one of the most subtle and entertaining subjects out there, I think. And I reckon it offers reasons for not talking to the police that are at a, if you like, a something of a different level from the stuff that Professor Duane's dealing with. Every single one of them that I've listened to is well worth listening to more than once, in fact. So there we had it. We had the advice that there's not only a massive amount of so-called laws, statutes in America and in here, over here, but that also there's practically an infinite variety of possible circumstances that might trigger an investigation. So quite apart from anything that's going on, almost all of the variables that are around whatever occurrence it is that we're interested in are unknown to the people involved. And as the police wander around the place talking to people, they come up with things that make them suspicious, I guess, make them want to write some paperwork, issue a warrant, come and knock on a few doors. And of course, whilst there might be many thousands of laws and even more thousands of statutory instruments and bylaws and other things that are required to make the so-called laws work, there's an even bigger variety of background information about which we can know nothing until, as it's pointed out, it turns up on the play court in front of us. There's all sorts of statements that might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant to some investigation. That's that. I love that. Lots of statements that might later appear to a prosecutor to be relevant. So, really, I guess one of the basic things he's saying is that one of the reasons why we should not be talking to these representatives in a uniform style address is because it is up to them, really, what they deem to be worthy of prosecution and how they're going to approach it. Also, of course, we know that as a matter of course, stuff that might be to our benefit is occasionally, and I'm sure by accident, withheld. As a matter of interest, actually, there was a bit of an example here of how the internet works in terms of a research engine as well. I was quite amused by this because, of course, we realise that we've got many thousands of statutes over in the UK. We don't really know how many there are, and we heard Professor Duane saying that the federal people don't know how many they've got either. But I thought I'd have a go at the internet. You know, Google's algorithms are particularly effective. So the first question I put in was what is a statute? Just to find out what people would find out, as it were, if they were to ask the question. And I got the answer that it's a written law passed by a legislative body. And then there's a bit of a colon. And as an example, they give the phrase violation of the hate crimes statute. I'm always interested by the examples they choose to illustrate kind of grammatical and definitive points, as it were. The latest Oxford Dictionary of English usage, I think it is. I reckon, and I'm not the only one because I passed it past a few other people, that every single example that is given in that book, and of course there's many tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of them, is actually in some way kind of weighted. You just get the feeling that they're not neutral offerings in terms of examples. As well as the a written law passed by a legislative body, underneath it in a nice square box with no source was the statement, a rule of an organisation or institution. And the example for that was the appointment will be subject to the statutes of the university. So that wasn't particularly informative. Wikipedia was a bit better, I thought. It came up with a statute is a formal written enactment of a legislative authority that governs a state, city or county. Well, we kind of know that that's closer to the truth, but the real crack here is that the question I wanted to ask was how many statutes are there? And I put that question in and I got 26,500,000 hits. That's what the first line said. The next line said, showing results for how many statues are there? So the algorithm perfectly understood what is a statute. It didn't understand how many statutes are there. And the first result under how many statues are there was how many statues of liberty are there and where are they located? And frankly, I was absolutely amazed at how quickly that one veered away from the from the main subject at hand, as it were. And I kind of remembered that I must admit my internet searching capability is pretty limited, really. But I did remember that in the old days, you used to be able to put inverted commas around something to make sure that it actually paid attention to what you wanted it to pay attention to rather than what the algorithm might prefer. So I put in how many statutes are there with statutes in inverted commas, and it came back with, did you mean how many statues are there with statues in inverted commas? And I thought, given how sharp that algorithm used to be compared with the other search algorithms we had, I thought, that surely can't be an accident. It can't surely just be a piece of crap software. So I feel that that's one of these kind of askance glimpses we're occasionally granted as to how these technological systems are actually working around us. And perhaps a little bit of, hang on a moment, I've just been distracted by the request to restart. There we go, restart later. There you go. So I still don't know how many statutes there are. We do know that there's many thousands of them. We know that they're supported by many thousands of statutory instruments, which are things that aid them to work. And we know that there are also even more thousands of bylaws and other kind of sub-restrictions, as we might say. Apparently in the UK, are gathered through further searching for how many statutes are there, that we can just about, if we're lucky, and if we're prepared to actually get online and do the counting ourselves, because the figures are not, I gather, published, we can tell how many statutes are enacted in any single year and how many have been repealed in that year. But that really is about as far as it goes. You've got no idea how many there are or how many statutory instruments or anything. So clearly there is absolutely no chance at all of getting a hang of any of those, and even if you are one of the kind of legal experts or the oratorially profound or whatever, you stand very little chance of weaving your way through that lot. So I guess it's best to bear in mind that ignorance of the fact that legislation is not law is no excuse. That's probably about the best way we can put that. The ABA, whoever they are, apparently believe that there are some at least 10,000 federal laws. 10,000. And most of us, I suspect, at some point in the beginnings of our research have looked into the nature of some of these laws and statutes and have seen just exactly how complicated they are. It's also my impression that they are very rarely repealed, that it would be extremely happy and just circumstance if for every pound of new legislation that was introduced, there was at least a pound of old legislation repealed. I particularly enjoyed the story about how illegal it is to have a short fish in America, a short lobster specifically, especially if that is prohibited by law in somewhere like New Guinea or wherever it was, he said. So that basically that particular piece of legislation that was read out actually meant that it was not smiled upon to break not only that legislation in the United States, but any similar legislation from any country, I presume any country in the world, certainly at least any country in the world that the US is dealing with. And there's nothing you could do about it. If you were found in possession of a short lobster, then there was absolutely nothing you could do to excuse yourself from it. You were, as he said, doomed. There are a lot of such laws in America, as it turns out. I should imagine there's a fair few here as well. It brings me to one of the very few shows that I still listen to on BBC Radio 4, which is, I can't remember what it's called now, The Unbelievable Truth. The idea is that they get a bunch of very witty and eloquent people on, and they get each of them, I think it's four, they get each of them to talk on a subject for a couple of minutes, and the idea is that they smuggle five lies past the rest of the crew that are on the show, and the rest of their presentation can be true. And one of the ways of getting through this show is to come up with lists of things, one of which is true and three of which are as bizarre as the true thing but undetectable. And American Laws is one of the places that they go to list quite often. So we've recently heard that snot flicking into the wind is apparently illegal in some American states. Better still is it's illegal to allow a donkey to go to sleep in a bath in some places. Now, you really would be hard pushed, wouldn't you, to kind of actually guess any of this stuff. One of the things I heard on that show that was really great was somebody smuggled past the truth that 17 recent American presidents were actually related to Elvis Presley. Nobody felt that there was any chance of that being true, so it got the person who said it a point, because it was in fact true, even if nobody spotted it. That's actually recently apropos being taken one step further. I'll try and find the link when I play the next tune, but apparently a 12-year-old girl in America, by pursuing matrilineal rather than patrilineal lines, has managed to demonstrate that 35 out of the last 36 US presidents are in fact related to John Plantagenet, the man who signed the Magna Carta. Quite an amazing thing for a 12-year-old to have pulled off that. I think she's also worked out that she's 18th cousin to Barack Obama or something. I'll put the link for that into the chat box when I get a moment. To go back to what Professor Duane was saying, I seem to have wandered off a little bit there, perhaps unsurprisingly. I think one of the things that was particularly disturbing to me, and surely would be to anybody who's considering the subject, is that it appears to be all right to feed details of a crime to a mentally ill man, to lie to him, and then to convince him that if he were to supply you with a confession, then that would help catch whoever the genuine scroat is. And we know, I've heard it before, we know specifically from Truth Juice Dave and from one or two other people who've been on the show, that these representatives are allowed, possibly even encouraged, to lie to us and mislead us in their attempts to gain information as to perhaps what is the truth from us. And that is something that I really didn't expect. You know, it's, I guess, kind of second nature now that that's what's kind of going on. But what on earth is the point of trying to establish the truth from one person if you are genuinely trying to establish the truth by lying to them, misleading them, and taking advantage of any apparent weakness that they might have in order to work things in your own interest? The US Supreme Court on that subject said even the truthful responses of an innocent witness may provide the government with incriminating evidence from the speaker's own mouth. That's truthful responses from an innocent witness. And that's the US Supreme Court saying that. And again, I might find that a bit incredible, but during the 2 weeks that I spent doing jury service in England, I remember I sat on what was a murder trial, and I remember that the witnesses appeared to be more nervous actually than the man that was in the dock. And in fact, it seemed to me that several of the witnesses, maybe half of them, didn't appear to understand what they were doing in the court in the first place. They didn't seem to comprehend that they were there to tell a story that was to do with a third party, as it were. Many of them were behaving as if anything they said whilst they were in there might lead to them themselves being incarcerated or fined or whatever. And at the time I thought that was maybe a bit extreme, and maybe it would have been useful to the court if they'd been informed of that. Maybe we'd have got better information from them and they'd have felt a bit more relaxed about what was going on. But here I actually hear a representative of a Supreme Court telling me that their nervousness is very well placed, unless you're extremely careful. Just by being a truthful witness, you can get yourself into trouble, which surely should give anybody who hears that and understands it must surely be given pause for thought. There's a bit where Professor Duane does a kind of pop quiz on witness competency as well. Remember that bit where he reads out a bit of stuff from the local paper about a bunch of people who've died, and then asks his audience how many people were shot. And basically by using the word shot, he fools nearly all of them, because of course he didn't at any point mention bullets or guns or anything. He simply called it a gangland style slaying, I think was the phrase that he used. And that is how easy it is. He just slipped in the word shot there, and most of his audience were fooled by it. If you go and look at the link, you'll see how many of them stick their hands up for that one. And of course we know that witnesses are unreliable. I mean, we can't even be sure to tell you the truth what's actually happening about us in the moment. We certainly can't be sure that what we remember about it is anything like correct. There's of course a famous example of it. There's been many experiments into this. One that I remember that I haven't been able to find the details for because of my inadequate searching facility, I no doubt, but was a bit of research that was run in America, I think, where there was broadly speaking, this is the gist of it, there was a lecture hall full of students, and during a lecture, two men burst into the room. One of them was a white man, one of them was a black man, and the white man was assailing the black man with a banana. That was the long and short of it. And they then kind of ushered themselves out of the lecture hall, and all of the students were asked to give some sort of account as to what they thought had happened in front of them. And much to the amazement of the experimenters, apparently the vast majority of the students saw the black man attacking the white man with a knife, not the white man having a go at the black man with a banana. Even more impressive, I think, is one that you can actually see working on the internet. Oh, my computer's slowing down a bit here. I hope you can all still hear me. Looks like it's working. I think you can actually see this on the internet if you put in something like basketball, and I think I'm beginning to wonder actually whether my computer is properly plugged in. It keeps going on to rest, so do stay with me if I disappear. Yeah, I think that you can see this particular psychology experiment on the internet where basically there's two teams playing basketball. Some subjects are given the job of counting how many times the white team passed the ball to the red team, or whatever it is, and during the basketball match, a bloke in a monkey suit starts aping around not only on the basketball pitch, but he starts moving around in front of the guys and watch how many times the ball's being passed. And all good, that's ball's being passed. But absolutely none to see the guy in the monkey suit. And that is physically a bloke dressed as a monkey in a basketball game where people are being attentive, where they know they're actually being given some sort of task, where they know they have to be kind of acute, as it were, and pay attention. And yet, all they see is the thing that they're being asked to pay attention to. And almost as a result of that point of attention, everything else disappears. I was hoping to play a bit of a game with the slideshow this week on the TNS site, because we've got a few camouflaged things, which are very difficult to see. But I discovered that I could look at some of these pictures and not see the thing that was in them until I read the caption underneath. And as soon as I saw the word describing the thing that was hidden in the picture, it just kind of appeared in front of my eyes. I'll perhaps get that together for next week so we can have a bit of a game with that. But all of this means that the actual reliability of witnesses is highly, highly dodgy. And of course, it doesn't matter how good you think you are. You've got to bear in mind that there's going to be a lot of other people involved, an unknown number of people involved, in fact, whose memory might not be as perfect, crystal, and well formed as our own. I think the main thing though really is that just by engaging, and this is I guess one of the messages of the subject matter jurisdiction, is that just by engaging we are in some sense entering the field of play. And if we can continue to ask questions rather than answer them, and as far as possible to avoid agreeing or acknowledging anything, it is the only safe way of keeping ourselves out of trouble. And I mean, they're quite shocking things, really, that I didn't manage to catch all of the 8 things that Professor Duane was doing. I suspect he kind of overran himself and lost count a little bit. But his most fundamental point was that it can't help. There's no way that actually talking to these people can do anything other, it appears, than help them. As they point out, anything you say really can and will be used against you. And as Professor Duane pointed out, it can't be used to help you. He says that basically anything that you say to the investigating officers that might be used to help you ends up being hearsay by the time it turns up in the court, whilst everything else you've said that is not to your use, of course, is not hearsay. So that's a very interesting and subtle distinction that's being made there somewhere. And whether you're guilty or innocent, just by talking to them, you may accidentally declare your guilt for absolutely no benefit in return. And the argument there, of course, is that even if, as you progress to the court, you end up confessing your own guilt, and as we heard, that can be done in many ways, at least you might end up serving 3 years instead of 5. Whereas if you do it by the side of the road, you are once again, as he puts it, doomed. And I was particularly struck by the fact that 86% of the people that are approaching the court system in the United States plead guilty before they get to trial. That's a vast saving in money, isn't it? But then, when we hear the second half of this podcast, when we hear Officer Brooks telling us some of the tricks he uses to catch the people that he's interviewing, and some of the things that can be deemed to be a confession, we'll perhaps be a little less surprised about the fact that 86% of people are somehow pleading guilty. And then the business of when you do start talking to them, obviously your tongue gets a bit looser, one tends to get a little bit more relaxed and all of that, and we might tell a whole load of truths, but then there might be something sneaks in that's just a little bit of story, a little bit of a lie, not quite as accurate as it might be. And that can end up be something, because it can undermine what might be seen as our reliability. One little lie. You know, I mean, I think, in fairness, maybe many of us work like that. You know, we're happy with people that we're working with. But yeah, if somebody has lied to you, and you know they have lied to you, then it doesn't make as much sense to trust them as fully as people who, you know, you haven't found such evidence for. So these little lie, little tale, something that would be apparently completely innocent and apparently of completely no importance at all, can end up undermining completely everything, because it undermines confidence. And on that subject, Professor Duane says that if you are talking to the police, then you will always give them information that will help to convict, always. And he's got a lot of experience. Then there's the point that, and this is something that, again, we're well aware of, that the police may not recall the testimony you gave with 100% accuracy. I've spoken before about the number of miscarriages of justice that have been in this country that have been proven and documented, and it takes ages and ages for people who go down, unjustifiably sometimes, to get back out again. And a lot of that is not even to do with testimony not being recalled properly. A lot of that is to do with the fact that testimony has been recalled properly, noted, and then stashed away so that it doesn't come up in the first place. And then, of course, there's that last unfortunate bit where the police may end up in possession of evidence that can be even false and unreliable evidence, but it may help to convict you, but only if you've engaged in the first place. Because then it becomes a battle of our word against theirs. So, a few thoughts on Professor Duane's thing there. As I say, it is one of those ones that I've played to people, and it is really quite shocking. I know we don't necessarily approve of waking people up by pouring a bucket of cold water over them, but that particular podcast I have found to be extremely effective, shall we say. Well, I'm going to play a couple of tunes now before we come back for the second half of that pod and hear just exactly how it is that Officer Brooks deals honestly, or at least creatively, with the people that he's given the job of interviewing. They never interrogate. We hear that. In the meantime, here's a couple of tunes. First one, Babylon's Burning by The Clash. Ghost Town by The Specials. Everything seems to be working pretty well here again now. It's should be able to hack another hour and a half or so without falling over again. So, but just in case it doesn't, let's move straight on into the second part of the Don't Talk to the Police Under Any Circumstances, in which an officer describes some of the techniques they use, well, to entrap us, basically. That's all I can say. He's, I don't know, what do you do with these people?
Officer George Group, the Virginia Beach Police Department.
I cannot talk that fast. Not even interviewing. I'm going to take the podium here, Professor. Because I took notes on some of the things you said. And everything he said was true. Okay? And it was right, and it was correct. And I'm just going to give you a few ideas. I'm going to tell you a few examples. But first, I'm going to give you a little information. As was said earlier, I've interviewed thousands of people. I've interviewed people with foreign police departments. When I was in the Navy, I was in law enforcement, and I was a criminal investigator. Thank God we're in the United States, because most interviews in Italy, Spain, and so forth start out physically. Okay, there's no police abuse over there. They can do pretty much what they want, anytime they want, anyhow they want. So just be aware of that and be thankful for that. Biggest question I was asked when I first, I am a 3L, and there's some of my classmates in here. Best day is coming up, May 10th, when we get to leave. So those of you that are applying, and I told a couple of people this, you think it's hard getting into law school? Try getting out. Okay? A couple of things I was asked. How do I quit from getting speeding tickets? Very easy question. Quit speeding. Okay? But something Professor Duane brought up, are any of you guilty of anything? How many of you drove here today? Anybody go above 55 on the interstate? Anybody drive at home and go above 55 on the interstate? Because if you stay...
I did it intentionally.
And there you go. And people are inherently honest, and that's their biggest downfall. Okay, they really are. Or they want to tell their story. And if you drive 55 on the interstate where it's 55, the only thing you're going to do is meet the person behind you, because they're going to rear end you and you're going to get run over. Okay, so that's a fact. But everybody does something that they can get in trouble for. I can follow as a police officer when I was in uniform. I could follow a car however long I needed to, and eventually they're going to do something illegal, and I can pull them over. And justifiably illegal to pull them over. So just be aware of that. Don't think you're so innocent in such a thing. When you get stopped for a traffic ticket, everyone likes to be somewhat honest. And what's the first thing the police officer asks you? Do you know how fast you're going? If the speed limit's 35, you'll say, oh, 38, 40, because you want to be kind of honest even though you're doing 50. You just said 38, 40. You just admitted to breaking the law. You just confessed. So they can go to court with that, with a confession that you were exceeding the speed limit. Okay, so you need to think about those things, and when you do become defense attorneys, which I may, who knows? You need to think about those things for your clients. The other thing you need to think about your clients, and this is going to seem very terse, people are stupid. Your clients are stupid. And I've had defense attorneys come up to me. Matter of fact, one on a motion to suppress just Tuesday come up to me and tell me his client was stupid. Okay? They're very straightforward. They do foolish things. They talk to the police. You guys need to be aware of that. Now, in my past, and it wasn't exaggerated, I have interviewed thousands of people. I have I've arrested and dealt with over 1,000 felonies. Well, actually, more than 1,000 felonies. Probably about 1,000 felonies, 2,500 misdemeanors, 98% of them conviction rate, 80% of them I don't even have to go to court. Why? Because there's confessions. Because they confess. So these people have no problem. The hardened criminals have no problem talking to the police. People like to tell their story. And they'll sit in that room and think about it. You're picked up by the police. You're in a little room. There's one chair here. There's a desk. There's another chair. What's the thing you want the most right at that point to get out of that room? be out of that room. Think the police officer's shift is ending in 15 minutes. Does a police officer want to get out of that room? My overtime rate's $58 an hour. Do I want to get out of that room? I have no problem. I'll stay there for 10 hours. I'll take that $600. Okay. So I have no motivation to want to leave. You do. And that's how we get you to try to talk. I have my job. My job is to develop probable cause, develop a good case. A great case is a case with a confession. Get it to the Commonwealth's attorney so that they can prosecute the case with little, if any, effort. And the Commonwealth attorneys love those cases, the little and any effort, because they come with a stack of files that high in court every day. So they love those cases. That's my job. The defense attorney's job is to hope they get to their client before I do and make sure they don't talk to me, no matter what. I'll give you an example, and this will go right along with what Professor Duane was putting up his examples. I had an interview that went something like this. Were you involved in the burglaries? No, I had nothing to do with them. You didn't have anything to do with them? No. You were in a car with all this stolen stuff in it? You had nothing to do about it? No. You knew it was there? Yeah. Okay, now we got possession of stolen property, felony. Okay? But you had nothing to do with it? No. So what did you need the money for? Well, I had to pay some of my court costs from another thing I got in trouble for. Oh, so he took the money from stealing the stuff. I have enough to charge him now with burglary. Simple as that. Well, did you see the picture on that camera of the house with the Christmas decorations? This is a real case scenario. Yeah, did you go in that house? No, I didn't go into that one. So there's ways around it. There's ways to get around people who try not to talk to you. And again, as Professor Duane said, if you wanted to go and say you wanted to go into a boxing match, $100 if you win. You've never boxed before. You have to face somebody who's an Olympic boxer. You're going to lose. You're going to face somebody who's been interviewing people for, in my case, 28 years. You're going to lose, unless you're purely innocent. Now, on the other side of it, I don't want to put anyone that's innocent in jail. But I try not to bring anyone into the interview room that's innocent. And there are a couple that I have let walk away because they were innocent. Okay, the interviews. How do we approach the interviews? There's a number of ways to approach interviews. There's a number of types of people that I deal with. First thing I do, anyone know what they get told first when they're in an interview? Miranda. Miranda warning. Okay, it's not a right. You don't have a right to Miranda. Those rights have always been there. It's called the Constitution. You're just teaching. You're doing a real quick class on the Constitution for these people. Usually they don't listen to it. And this is the way I give my Miranda warning. Look, I have to tell you this. Just pay attention. Okay, they're usually sitting back or they're very attentive. You have the right to remain silent. Do you understand that? Yes. Anything you say may be used against you in a court. I don't have to say it will be. I say it may be. Okay, and they get that. You have a right to an attorney, and if you can't afford one, one may be appointed to represent you. Got that. You can decide not to talk, quit talking to me at any time and exercise these rights. Do you understand that? Sure. Now, before I do the primary thing that's needed with those rights, and that's to get a waiver, I say, now, before you say anything, let me tell you what I know. And over all the time I've had to put together what this individual was supposedly involved in, and I only say supposedly because Professor Duane's sitting over there, that this individual was involved in, I will tell the story that I've put together, and it'll be pretty close to what happened. And I can see that it's pretty close to what happened because that individual starts slumping down in their chair. Or they'll put their hand to their face, doing this in their mind. Oh, my God, I'm going to jail forever. Okay? And I can see it. I said, now that you know what I know, do you want to talk to me? And why do I do that? Because if I didn't do that, is if I said, do you want to talk to me, they'll say no. So I give them the time to think about, and then comes the next phrase. Now, before you start talking to me, let me tell you the difference between a lie and a truth. If you lie to me and I get before the judge and I tell the judge that you were dishonest with me, that's just not going to make him happy. But if I get before the judge and tell him you're honest, straightforward, willing to take responsibility for your actions, that is going to help you. That's not a lie, though. That is true. In Virginia Beach courts, it will help them. You know, they may not get 5 years. They may get 3 years. They're still going to prison. Or they're still going to have a felony, but it will help them. And then I have to determine what kind of person I am. And there's two types. There's the one, like I mentioned to you earlier, where I have to talk to them about different things, get into their own skin, as the word is, and try and get them to talk to me and discuss things. I had a sexual assault case. I had to talk to the guy how hot the woman was, and I understand where he was coming from. And when I said that, we were buds. And he started talking to me. And he's still sitting in prison. Okay? So you've got to get in there and you've got to go place. The other side is, I can't try and act like that individual acts. Okay? I can't try and act like what we call lovingly a hood rat. I can't try and act and talk like him. Because I'm an older white guy. We don't talk like that, and that would be an insult. And you can't insult people. It doesn't matter who they are. It doesn't matter where they grew up. It doesn't matter where they're from. You can't insult people like that. You have to be yourself. So you have to get into their mindset and the way they're thinking and have a discussion with them. The other type of person is the one that likes to tell a story. This young man, great man. I love him to death. He didn't go to jail because I went to bat for him. Because I felt sorry for him. He was a newlywed. He was having money problems. Former Marine. I said, tell me what happened. And he told me this beautiful story about what happened. What he had done is he had sold a piece of equipment that his ex-employer had that he had stolen. He told me the beautiful story of what happened about him finding it on the side of the road and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't even question about him. After he finished his whole story, very unplausible, but very beautiful story. I sat there and listened to it for 15 minutes. I looked at him and I said, you stole the stuff from your boss, didn't you? Yes, sir, I did. I had nothing. I really had nothing except the fact that he had sold it. So there's those types of people. And then the third type, the one who tries to be the hood, who tries to be the criminal, who cries like a baby when they walk into jail, but when they're on the street, they're as tough as rocks. You go in there with your paperwork, you sit down, and you just start doing paperwork. And usually I have a videotape sitting on top of it just for measure, so they think I have a videotape. And you just sit there. Don't tell them Miranda. Just sit there and wait for them to start talking. Because they will. They want to talk. People want to communicate. They hate silence. That's why when people speak, you hear, when they're talking, because they need to fill that void with something. People hate silence. So that's the other one. A couple tricks of the trade, and I'll share this with you for when you may go in an interview room. If you're going to be attorneys, it could happen. Videotapes are wonderful things. I use a tape recorder. How many of you think if you saw a tape recorder, that would make you not want to talk? Yeah. They talk, and this is how I do it. I bring the tape recorder and say, look, I'm going to use this recorder because my writing's terrible. I can't read it if I write it down, so I'm going to use this. Is that all right with you? Don't have to ask me. Is that all right? Yeah, no problem. So I turn it on. And they watch the tape recorder. And if I have a problem with the interview, I'll say, I want to talk to you for a second, just off the record. Everyone here off the record? It's like a unicorn. No such thing. I pick up the tape recorder. I borrow this. I pick up the tape recorder, and I go click and turn it off and set it right in front of them. And they look at the tape to make sure it's not turning. Interview rooms have microphones in them and video cameras, and everything that happens in there is recorded. My tape means nothing because I'm recording it anyways. And then I start talking to them quietly, and they start telling me stuff. And they do something like that, except it's crying. It's more crying. So that's another way. So you see how there's an unlevel playing field here. Even with the most educated individual, there's an unlevel playing field. If you talk to the police, everything's going to be written down. If you get pulled over for a ticket, they give you the ticket and you pull off. You ever see the cop pull off right after you? Usually not. That's because on the back of their ticket, they're writing down everything you said. And it's going to come into court if you go to court. Everything that's said, I write down. Every phone call I make has to have a listening device on it. Is that illegal? How many parties need to know that a phone conversation in Virginia is being recorded? One. Me. I knew it was recorded. I get many, many confessions over the phone. Okay, back to the people. Yes, they're stupid. Okay, people are stupid. I had a young man who told me straight up, I'm going to college. I'm going to law school. I'm too smart. You'll never find out what happened. Okay. He was going to Tidewater Community College. The law school of, I suppose, Tidewater Community College. He was the partner to the one who I told you to interview about just a little while ago, where I would ask him what he needed the money for. He was his partner. And he was very smart. So he thought. He thought he was a very intelligent individual. I ended up arresting him 5 times out of his house. His mother hated me. She liked me the first time. She apologized. She didn't really like me much the second time. It got to the point where she really hated me after that. He's doing 8 years upstate. He's very smart because he decided to tell me how smart he was. And in telling me how smart he was, he let it slip that he doesn't sell stolen stuff to pawn shops. He sells it to flea markets because they do not have to report to the state. I know how to drive to a flea market just as good as anyone else and go look for stuff that I'm looking for. So he was trying to impress me with his ability to be smarter than I was, and he confessed. So people are inherently stupid, especially criminals. Now, and don't get me wrong, there are some very intelligent criminals out there, and most of them work in really big office buildings and wear suits. Yep, she went to jail. Is she hurting? No. But there are some very intelligent street criminals out there as well that get other people to do their bidding and so forth and so on, and people are afraid to turn on them. But there are some very foolish people. Just a couple other things. I do a thing usually with younger people, usually between the age of, I try not to deal too much with juveniles, but between the age of 16 and 25, is once they've talked to me. Now, let's back up a little bit. You don't need a recording in court for a statement. As Professor Duane said, it's his word against my word if he was a defendant. Number one, and this is the way it works, and this is the way the real world works, in case you guys haven't been out there, that's outside the windows out there. The jury looks at a defendant sitting next to a defense attorney. That's strike one, because the jury is already looking at that as that being someone who did something that put them in that chair. Number two, they get a uniformed police officer up there. They get someone wearing a suit as a detective up there that is a professional witness. That's strike two. So now they have a professional witness against them. And then if they've confessed and that professional witness is going to sit there and read from his or her notes, the confession, that's strike three, go get your orange jumpsuit, do not pass go, do not collect $200. So they have all the strikes against them. And I know you're innocent until proven guilty, but it's a jury of your peers. And the perception is if you're sitting next to a defense attorney, you have to prove you're innocent. And that's just the perception of a lot of the jury, no matter how many jury instructions they get. They still perceive that person is a hoodlum, is a criminal. And no matter how hard some defense attorneys try to put their clients in suits and have them sit up at the table, if the trial is a long trial, they fall back to their old ways and they start acting and speaking in a way that's not very good for their case. So saying that, you don't have to have a recording. My suppression hearing, a statement was trying to be suppressed because when I record a confession or an interview, because we don't do interrogations, the police. We do not do interrogations. That's a bad, mean, Nazi kind of word, okay? We do interviews, okay? And you'd be amazed how much difference it makes when you use that one word versus interrogation. I'll take it off the tape, and I'll have my secretary put it to paper. Immediately afterwards, I'll take that tape, and I'll scan it over my magnet, throw it in my box, so I can use it again. I do not keep the tape. It is not evidence. It's not required to be evidence. It is there. If it's there for the court, it's just extra. You don't have to have that. But it's really good to have. The suppression hearing, he tried to suppress that. After I testified, the defense counsel stood up and says, well, Judge, I really don't have anything to say. And the judge, Judge Canada, said motion denied. and let's move on and go to court. So you don't have to have recordings. You don't have to have videotapes. The police videotapes, that's just extra. If you got that police officer sitting there testifying, you don't have to have that videotape. You got the guy that was right there to tell you what happened. But it's always nice to have those extra things. And what I do for these young people is I'll say, look, the person who you broke into their house are very upset. They're very angry because you sold their stuff to the pawn shop. Pawn shop stuff, sold them. They don't get their stuff back. They're very angry. They want you to go to prison. Okay? They may be very angry. They want you to go to prison. They may want to. To lessen that, that's the start of what's commonly known as a lie, because we are allowed to lie in interviews. To lessen that, you might want to make them happy. And the reason that's a lie is because when it is a felony in the Commonwealth of Virginia, the victim has nothing to do with the prosecution or how long the people go to prison or any of that kind of stuff. We're prosecuting them, not the victim. But to lessen that, what I'd like you to do is write an apology letter to the person whose house you broke into. Just write it out. Well, how do I write it? In your own words, just write, you know, I'm sorry for what I did. Then say that, you know, when I broke into your house the other night, whatever. They write it out. They sign it. I sign it as a witness. I put the date and the time that it was written. I give it to the Commonwealth's attorney. It's entered as evidence as a written confession. In the person's own handwriting. I don't type it up again and have them sign it. In their handwriting, a written confession. Is that person going to get convicted? I have never seen them not get convicted on that. On an apology letter. So, in support of Professor Duane, everything he says is right.
Slade there, and one-way hotel. How long does it take to make a number of changes when you let them? And before that, the very nice Officer Brooks. Wasn't he a pleasant man? I hope his toast tastes good in the morning. He said that people are basically honest. Hang on a moment. Because I've rebooted the computer, the blips are back in again. I'll just dispose of that. He said that people are basically honest. And I guess he's probably right, broadly speaking. But if we make it as far as the ET 101 reading that I hope to do a little bit later on, then we're going to find out that actually telling the truth is something as regarded as close to a covert art on this planet as far as some entities are concerned. So people are honest in the way they're trained to be honest. It takes a while for us to learn to be genuinely honest with each other, and it's quite a painful and difficult process, but well worth undertaking. He's being generous when he says people are honest, because the next thing he says is people are stupid. And again, I get the feeling there, oh, it looks like we're having a bit of a problem with the mic. Now, there we go. Once again, if you've got, as he says, when you're going into an interview with one of these guys, it's like you're taking on a boxing match with a guy who's kind of, who's got 20 years experience, and you're going to lose. Under those circumstances, of course people appear stupid. You know, it doesn't matter how much we know about the things we know about. In most circumstances, we're not competent. In most circumstances, we're not informed. In most circumstances that we haven't experienced before, unless we're with somebody who has experienced those circumstances before, we don't stand a chance. So under some circumstances, all of us are stupid. And, I don't really like to use the word smug, but that was a word that sprung to mind when I was listening to those descriptions of the people that this man is coercing, 80% of them, into confessing, so there's no more effort required on his part. I can see that the visual audio feedback on the computer is getting a bit laggardly again. I'm sorry, it seems to be still coming out. Oh, it does make it a little bit difficult to concentrate though. And wasn't it funny the way the first thing he does is he says, you know, how many of you drove here and how many of you did more than 55, and they're sticking their hands up, and Prof Duane's out the back going, I told you not to tell him, you know, and that a lot of the things that were being laughed at there are things that really are quite serious. And the sticking the hands up when you're being questioned by a police officer after you've just had 27 and a half minutes of somebody telling you how much you shouldn't tell them what it is you've been doing It is funny, isn't it? It is funny because the funniest things are the things that are the closest to truth. But I really enjoyed that bit of it. He says that people are very straightforward and that they talk to the police. Well, yes, that's because even once you've realised, even partially what's going on, it's still extremely difficult to overcome however many years of conditioning it is you've had that tell you to go when the light goes green and stop when the red light comes on and speak honestly to the man in the uniform style of dress because it is in your interest so to do. It is extremely difficult, as we'll hear in a short while, to make the kind of about turn necessary to deal with that situation effectively. And presumably, there's quite a lot of excitement involved in getting to the point where you can. Like I said, 80% of the guys that this bloke's dealt with over 28 years have confessed. 80% of them. How much work's involved in that, eh? And remember that we heard, I can't remember which of the shows it was, but we heard recently that something like a third of the American gross domestic product actually comes from the penal system. That's not just from the actual enacting of the whole thing, but also from the various bits of military gear and other stuff that's turned out by the enormous number of people who end up being locked up because they've confessed to things. He also said that one of the things that was working in his part, as it were, was the fact that you're in a little room, he's paid to be there, he's on overtime, he's got all the technology, and all you want to do is get out of the room. I bet there's many people listening to this who know that experience. And of course it's absolutely true. The fact that you want to get up out of the room, coupled, as he says, with the fact that most people don't like silence, means that you make every effort to maneuver accordingly. Fight and flight are enacted. A tort has been committed upon you. The blood is running from your neocortex to your newt brain, and you do want to get out of there. And that is in the interest of the man who's questioning you. And as Guy Taylor pointed out a couple of weeks back, he said not only do we want to get out of the little room when we're in there, once we're out, we don't want to go back. We don't actually feel an urge to go and address the situation. So it's not only to our disadvantage when we're in there, it's to our disadvantage once we get out as well. And as Guy was saying, we owe it to ourselves to go and address it once we get out of the little room, because that's the best way of making sure that you don't get back in there again. He gave some what I thought was quite good advice, once again, taken perhaps for the purposes it was being used there. It's less than honourable, but it is true that it's important when we're dealing with people to at least, to some extent, try and get under their skin, to try and understand where it is they're coming from, how much they understand. And this is done by questioning rather than by making statements, by trying to learn what the basic situation is that we find ourselves operating under, to get under its skin. Because we know, and it's been pointed out again before, that any technique that works for one person will not necessarily work for the next person, although it might well work for the person after that. That almost irrespective of the methods being used, it is down to a heart-to-heart connection, eyeball-to-eyeball, with the individual men or women involved in the situation, and that somehow there's a kind of animating spirit that enters the situation from there and enables a safe escape or a little bit more hassle. But in order to do that, there has to be an attempt to genuinely listen, to genuinely get under the skin of the situation and try and feel what unique features are going to enable the individuals involved to resolve the situation satisfactorily. He says that it's not a good idea to insult people, and I think that's a really good piece of advice as well. It's easy accidentally to insult people. You don't have to call them a toe rag or a scrotum. Just by implying that they don't know what they're doing, you are in a way launching some kind of insult, and it never seems to me to help. Certainly a professional there, he thought that it was good to stay on the good side of people if you're screwing them. So it's good to stay on the good side of people if you're not. He also had absolutely no shame in admitting that he'd just put a video down in front of him to let the person he was questioning believe that there was maybe some video evidence. He made sure he had plenty of documents, and he made use of silence. which is something, as you know, I've recommended before. The act of not saying anything if you haven't got anything useful to say, and as has been made quite clear under these circumstances, one definitely has nothing useful to say. This again, it's not only under these circumstances that that particular technique is effective. In situations where you're dealing with, where one is dealing with unfamiliar people or people whose motivations one cannot be completely certain of, then I've found that staying quiet for prolonged periods if necessary can not only save a lot of grief in terms of actually saying things that one might not want to say under the circumstances, but it also leads to a lot more information coming from one's interlocutor, generally speaking. Officer Brooks was really proud of his trick with the tape recorder, having he pointed out that there's video recorders and tape recorders and mirrors and all sorts of stuff running in all sorts of interview rooms, all interview rooms, in fact, probably in most pubs, everywhere where there's a television, everywhere where there's a laptop, maybe everywhere where there's a mobile phone. These facilities are running, and yet he still feels that he can bring out the Sweeney type sort of C90 tape record button with the stop go button, and it works. And it works, folks. You heard him say it himself, that people see the tape stop working and they start talking. And it would be really, really unfair to think that it is only the people who find themselves in that little room who are that seriously conditioned. Because if that particular trick doesn't work, then I'll bet you there's one on any particular individual. I'll bet you there's one or two tricks that do work on the individuals that the tape recorder trick doesn't work on. Off the record, he says, is like a unicorn, it doesn't exist. Which again is absolutely fair. The welfare, he was pointing just that thing out in the hour before the Dr. Rock show, saying that in the old days that the systems were not linked up, it was very difficult to move information around. There was, as they said to me when I was at school, well, it wasn't the people at the school that said it, but I was told there is no permanent record. Well, there is now. Everything's on the record. It's just a question of whether anybody chooses to go back to look. And so just like the money, it's like a unicorn. It doesn't exist. So we're playing on seriously unlevel playing field. He also pointed out that if you get a traffic stop and they kind of deal with you and they tell you to go away or whatever it is they do, then they won't pull away at the same time as you do. Because at least in the case of this man's experience, the ticket they've issued is having everything that's been said written down on it. Now, the writing down of stuff was something that used to happen in front of us in a little black notebook. And, of course, it is something that is thoroughly recommended to have your own little notebook, your own little pen, and write down everything that's said. It is, as the man pointed out, can be vitally important. It is some of the best evidence you can get live from the scene, contemporaneous notes. But most of all, it slows everything down and gives you time to think, gives the blood pressure a bit time to kind of drop, as it were. Write everything down, he said, and write everything down. I think it's a great idea. He said he didn't make any phone calls without there being a listening device, and where he comes from, only one person needs to know that the call is being recorded. That also might be a good principle to enact, but sometimes it's nice to let people know they're being recorded, especially halfway through. I don't know what the legislation is on that subject here, but by and large, it does seem to me to be a good idea when, as was pointed out in the first half, memories can be a little lax as to what was said. It seems to be a good idea to have an audio record if you can. And one of the most striking things I think he said was that just by being in the court with a defence attorney next to you, you've already hit strike one. And as far as you're there in front of a jury and you've got a defence attorney, which must mean that you're a ne'er-do-well. And again, I'm sure this is familiar to most of the people who are listening, but it's not yet familiar to most of the population, although I'm sure it's coming closer to them, that as soon as you are seen to be, for whatever reason, associated with uniformed representatives of the world management team, many of the people who've known you for a long, long time and know where you're coming from and all the things you do will be similarly convinced that you are a ne'er-do-well just overnight and just like that, and for no other reason than your proximity to somebody who's dressed strangely. quite amazing. He also pointed out that on that basis, a uniformed professional witness, you've got your defense attorney on one side, a uniformed professional witness, that's strike two, he says, because that makes it even more certain that the people that are being looked at are the person being looked at is has been up to no good. One of the reasons why this happens is because it's ever so easy under the conditioning that we've got to see the difference between one person, one individual and another, and to imagine that we can never be subject to such discriminating judgments ourselves, that we will never somehow be shaved off from the edge of the crowd and made to appear different. But this is that process precisely. Somebody who we can look at and go, well, look at that, there you go, defense attorney, expert witness, blimey, you wouldn't find me there. But, as we've heard, the poor person might never have done anything in the first place. And then the confession is strike three, and I do still, as I put in the chat box, I do still find this behaviour really quite shocking. I find it amazing that you can sit down in a back room in a policy enforcement centre of some sort and talk somebody into writing a writing an apology to somebody whose house they've burgled, and then use that apology, use the very handwritten apology signed with the sign of nature at the bottom of it as a confession. So the 80% of people who confess under those circumstances, I guess it's not entirely surprising. Many of them perhaps don't realise what they're doing. But really, right from strike one, he says, right from the point where you're seen with a defence attorney, the fact that, at least in theory, we are innocent until proved guilty, from that moment on, he says, it is your job to prove to the jury that you are in fact innocent. It is not the job of the prosecution necessarily to prove that you're guilty. He made a nice distinction and said that people in America interview, they don't interrogate. Well, we've seen some very interesting interviewing techniques out on the streets in front of the closed circuit TV cameras, haven't we? I'm sure that tools for interviewing do not normally include big boots and baseball bats, but hey, that might be just my soft-arsed opinion. And as he points out, and as Dave pointed out to us and many people before, these people are allowed to lie in interviews. So there are hopefully a few good reasons for why we shouldn't talk to the police. There are many more that come out on TNS radio as time goes by. There's also lots and lots of different ways of not talking to the police, but the soundest piece of advice on the subject, I don't know who it was that coined it, is to say nothing and keep saying nothing. And on that note, I'm going to play another tune whilst I line up another bit of stuff I've got, which endeavours to look a little bit into why it is that even though it's quite clear, it's really obvious that a lot of the things that we're talking about are now manifestly true, I want to have just a quick look at why it is that the mass of people, the fast asleep, seem to be completely not interested at all in believing a single word we say.
Most of us who have lived with the events of 9/11 have, as a result, experienced some kind of trauma. It can be very difficult to come to terms with what actually happened at the World Trade Center. In fact, someone told me recently, "I wouldn't believe what you're telling me even if it were true." Our petition signers, with psychological expertise, have stepped forward to offer their insight. While this segment is clearly outside the knowledge base of the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, these experts in psychology highlight their valuable experience for us as to why this evidence can still be so difficult for people to accept.
As we know, the horrors of what happened on 9/11 were televised all over the world, and they were televised, in fact, live. We witnessed the deaths of almost 3,000 of our fellow Americans. We know this had a very severe and traumatic impact on a large majority of the population. At this point, we have 9 years of hard scientific evidence that disproves that government theory about what happened on September 11th, and yet people continue to be either oblivious to the fact that this information exists or completely resistant to looking at this information. So the question becomes why? Why is it that people have so much trouble hearing this information? From my work, I think we would be remiss not to look at the impact of trauma.
Many people respond to these truths in a very deep way. Some have a visceral reaction like they've been punched in the stomach. To begin to accept the possibility that the government was involved is like opening Pandora's box. If you open the lid and peek in a little bit, it's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world.
If we can think of our worldview as being sort of our mental and emotional home, I think all of us will do just about anything to defend our homes, to defend our families. And so I see that with people, and I saw that with myself when my brother tried to talk with me about it. Don't mess with me, don't mess with my home, don't mess with my comfort with how things are. About a week later, I read a lengthy article by Professor Griffin about why he believes the official account of 9/11 cannot be true. And it was a very well-researched article. It was in my office at the time. I sat there and I felt my stomach churning. I thought maybe I was going to be sick. And I leaped out of my chair and ran out the door and took a long walk around the block, around several blocks, and just broke down. I understand now that what was happening was my worldview about my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed, and it was like being cast out into the wilderness, I think is the closest way to describe that feeling. And I sobbed and I sobbed, felt like the ground had completely disappeared beneath my feet. And I knew at some point during the walk that I knew that I was going to have to become active in educating other people about this, that there was, that for me to retain any sense of integrity, I was going to have to take some action. I couldn't just let something like this go.
When we hear information that contradicts our worldview, social psychologists call the resulting insecurity cognitive dissonance. For example, with 9/11, we have one cognition, which is what the official story of 9/11, what our government told us, what our media repeated to us over and over, that 19 Muslims attacked us. On the other hand, we have what scientists, researchers, architects, engineers are now beginning to tell us, which is that there is evidence that shows that the official story cannot be true. So now we've lost our sense of security. We are starting to feel vulnerable. Now we're confused.
9/11 truth challenges the beliefs that our country protects us and keeps us safe, and that America is the good guy. When your beliefs are challenged, fear and anxiety are created. In response to that, our psychological defenses kick in, and they protect us from these emotions. Denial, which is probably the most primitive psychological defense, is the one most likely to kick in when our beliefs are challenged.
And it's a very, very uncomfortable state to be in. And eventually, our mind shuts off. Just like when a computer is overloaded, our minds get overloaded. We can't handle it anymore, and we shut down.
And what some of us will tend to do is deny the evidence that's coming our way and stick to the original story, the official story, and to try to regain our equilibrium in that way. Another thing we can do is decide to look at the conflicting evidence and be sincere and be open-minded and look at both sides of the issue and then make up our own mind about what reality is. Here are a few of those spontaneous initial reactions to hearing the contradictory evidence about 9/11.
I don't want to know the truth, or I'd become too negative and psychologically go downhill. I'm not sure I want to know. If this is true, then up would be down and down would be up. My life would never be the same.
Fran, I refuse to believe that that many Americans could be that satanically treasonous. Someone would have talked. But these are beliefs. They are not scientific facts. But these beliefs do keep us from looking at the empirical evidence. Whenever we say, "I refuse to believe," we can be sure that the evidence that's coming our way is not bearable and that it's conflicting with our worldview much too much. As I thought about all of these responses, I realized that what is common to every one of them is the emotion of fear. People are afraid of being ostracized, they're afraid of being alienated, they're afraid of being shunned, they're afraid of their lives being inconvenienced, they'd have to change their lives, they're afraid of being confused, they're afraid of psychological deterioration, they're afraid of feeling helpless and vulnerable. And they're afraid that they won't be able to handle the feelings that are coming up. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable.
Healing comes through facing the truth, experiencing it, allowing the feelings to come in, so that if there are feelings of fear that perhaps these events were caused by something that we haven't thought about yet, dark elements within our society, for example, we'll let that come in and explore it. Let the light shine on whatever happened. This will be the most healing process.
After World War II, part of the way that Jewish people honored the dead was by making sure that the truth was known and that the value of these people was respected. Not pursuing the truth about 9/11 disrespects the value of the life of the people that died. Thinking that we're above such things, that it could happen in other countries, but it couldn't happen here, that's a lack of humility, and that's excessive pride. And so not being able to see our dark side or our weaknesses is the most dangerous thing.
A feature of American history that makes us particularly liable to this pride is this notion that's called exceptionalism, that America is the exceptional nation. And that began from the beginning, as this country was formed. The people would say, well, there was so much evil in the European countries, so much cheating, so much lying, so much using the people for the ruler's purposes, but not in America. We have leaders that are free from those sins. So I think this has made 9/11 particularly difficult for Americans.
So we need to understand that questioning is patriotic. Questioning is what we're supposed to do as citizens. That's our duty.
When something like 9/11 happens, we need to be sure that we have a real investigation into who the perpetrators are, and then we need to be sure that those perpetrators are held legally accountable. It's part of the healing process on the individual level as on the collective level. We need the truth in order to heal.
You're listening live, hopefully, to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and scottishsovereignsontheland.ning.com. Well, the computer's really challenging me tonight. It's more like a video game as I switch things off and turn them back on again. And as things stop working, I have no idea at what point you lost me there, but I can see that I fell away. So you might not have heard the explanation for why I was playing that particular clip from a 9/11 vid that I saw, so I'll have to risk, as I did earlier on, repeating Babylon's Burning, repeating myself, but it's, I've had a couple of decent links recently to 9/11. It's something that keeps getting updated. We're now so far down the line from the great going away of buildings, kind of 11 years or whatever it is, and the sort of syntheses of data that are coming together are becoming really quite spectacular. And it clearly was a kind of world-changing event. We've now had, there was over 2,500 people dying live, as it were, on global TV. And that number's still going up, as far as I can gather. Over 1 million people have died in Afghanistan and Iraq as a result of the fallout from these activities. Apparently 6,000 United States troops have died in the war on terror, and it's cost $4.5 trillion, whatever that means. And civil liberties have been removed by the Patriot Act, by Military Commissions Act, the Department of Homeland Security, the Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, the National Defense Authorization Act 2012. And today, Americans can be subjected to unwarranted search and seizure, detained or imprisoned indefinitely without charge, without evidence, without a lawyer, without a trial. Not that any of that would do them any good, of course. Or they can even be tortured or assassinated merely for being accused of being associated with terrorism. And somehow the kind of fulcrum against which a lot of that has been so successfully achieved was 9/11. I posted the links, as I said, to the kind of financial background to the whole event, who got hit, who got out, and why, in the TNS chat box. And also the one to 9/11 explosive evidence, which is about the engineers and researchers who say that the official line, the line of the National Institute of Science and Technology, or whatever it's called, cannot be true. And the clip that I just played was a kind of addendum to the second, to the explosive evidence documentary, and it was just an afterthought, really, about some comments from psychologists as to the sort of effect that 9/11 was having on people. And I was particularly struck by the number of people who were saying, oh, I wouldn't believe what you were telling me, even if it were true. And there's all sorts of assumptions buried into that sentence. But most of all, there's a kind of acknowledgement there that it might be true, but you just can't afford to take it. I know somebody who says he'd rather be happy than right, which is a fair enough approach, I guess. That's, as I say, why 7,000 million of us are down here. There's somebody to believe everything. But when we were listening to Professor Duane earlier on, we heard how, quite simply, in front of a jury, the establishment of motive and opportunity, no matter how tenuous that establishment might be, is enough, you know, especially if there's a defence lawyer standing next to you in a bloke in uniform as well, then boom, down you go, that's it, no more evidence required. And yet, all this stuff, all the just the normal film footage you can see of the great going away of buildings surely tells you something's wrong. And yet, such information, the public or the jury, if you like, can't be convinced of that. On live global TV, 3,000 live deaths nearly, 9 years of evidence disproving the official line, and yet people remain oblivious and completely resistant to the information that is clearly there in front of them. And, of course, I do not need, I'm sure, to bring to your attention that that is true of so many things. So many things. Even the money. How could we possibly hear of somebody planning on minting a $15 trillion coin, depositing it in their own bank and going, oh, look, we're not in debt anymore. And yet that is the truth of it, isn't it? That is exactly where the money comes from. Absolutely amazing. How do people manage to avoid taking this sort of stuff on board? One thing, as I've said, is that I think that many people have got too much to lose. If really generations have gone into building onto kind of the, I don't know, zeros in the bank account, whatever it is that we define as success, influence, spin of money, all of that kind of stuff. If one was to acknowledge that it was completely illusion, was founded entirely on fraud and underwritten by the mafia, obviously there's a lot at risk in believing that. And that's one of the things that the people said at the end of the vid, was that it's like opening Pandora's box. It's going to challenge some of your fundamental beliefs about the world, was the phrase that was used. My discovery in tumbling down the rabbit hole has been that it is not some of your fundamental beliefs about the world that are challenged. It might be to start with, but in the long run, it is every single one of them, and at levels that you wouldn't even have occurred to you to think about before. And that's a major challenge. Maybe some people just instinctively know that if you let go, then you go in a tumbling right down the rabbit hole. You can't just do it a bit. You can't. Once the cardigan starts unravelling, then pretty shortly there ain't going to be a garment left at all. And that seems to me to be the way of it. And that is easy to forget, I guess, but if you're looking at something so huge as this particular event and all the people that were involved and the impossible events, just the amount of impossible stuff, let alone the undermining revelation of illusion and the rest that is there as well, with no other idea of change, no other idea of the illusion, no other realization of the looking glass world, then that one thing, that first thing, I can see how it might be a real put off to even think about it. And I thought the most striking one, the one that really drew my attention to this particular section of what is generally an excellent vid, I do really recommend those links for a watch, is when she first heard about this idea that the government might be behind it or what have you, her thoughts were, don't mess with my home. Don't mess with my comfort. Don't mess with how things are. And again, there's been a fair bit of conditioning mentioned in this show, and there's another bit. Don't mess with how things are. Change is the only universal constant. It's the only thing we can be sure of. But we just don't want people to mess with how things are. We don't want to let go of what we're used to. And as has been pointed out, again, I've no idea who it was that said this one, but people are frightened by big things, and this was a big thing. And she says she felt her stomach churning, and she took a long, long walk around the block, and then she broke down. She said, my world view of my government being in some way my protector, almost like a parent, had been dashed. It was like being cast out into the wilderness. I sobbed and sobbed, and felt that the ground had completely disappeared from beneath my feet. And again, that's somebody responding to this particular event, but I bet that is an experience which is common to nearly every single one of us. We all spent much of our lives being the way we were conditioned to be, doing the things we were conditioned to do, and then either gradually or normally quite suddenly there was a bit of awakening. And then it's a while before your ass hits the bottom of the hole as you go tumbling on down. It's just that I thought was such a perfect expression of it. And then what happens next is I knew that I was going to have to become active. That for me to retain any sense of integrity, I couldn't just let something like this go. And the scale on which that occurs is different from person to person. Sometimes it takes the destruction of 500,000 ton of building right in front of your very eyes. Other times, as I say, it can quite simply be a roadside stop. It might not even be your roadside stop. It might be that of a friend or your granny or whatever. But they're all stimuli to this kind of feeling, this kind of shock. All of them. It doesn't matter how small the actual key is, the actual trigger, as it were, that brings the whole thing tumbling down. The fact is that the thing has come tumbling down, and exactly the kind of shock that was being described by the psychologists with regard to 9/11, the great going away of buildings, is true right down to that tiny scale, all down to cognitive dissonance, which again, when you hear it so elegantly described, is once again something that we realise is all around us. And they described it really beautifully, I thought. They said you've got two cognitions, two understandings, two complete grokkings of the world around you, and they're mutually exclusive. It's doublethink in Orwell's 1984 terms. Cognition one is that the government and the media are telling you the truth, and that 19 Muslims with a couple of planes managed to blow up three steel reinforced buildings in an afternoon. That's cognition one. That's the truth. That's the only way it can have been. And cognition two is what the scientists, engineers, researchers, and even, you know, your own eyes, basically, which says that whatever the orthodox story is, it can't be true. Not that it might not be, but that it cannot be. It's admitted in the NIST report that they didn't find any evidence of explosives, but it's also admitted elsewhere in the report that because they knew explosives weren't going to be there, they didn't go looking for them. But these two different cognitions are in direct contrast to each other, and they lead to confusion. They lead specifically to a feeling of vulnerability and confusion, as what was highlighted in the vid. And the next words they used were states of fearfulness and anxiety. People became fearful and anxious because they were vulnerable and confused. And again, I stress that that happens from these big events right down to the little events, that it's difficult for us to react creatively when we're in that kind of state, though not completely impossible. And indeed, the psychologists themselves come up with some quite useful suggestions. But what arises out of the vulnerability and confusion is a need to, I don't know, escape, give ourselves time to think. And what arises is one of what they describe as the most primal responses, which is denial. I cannot believe you. I refuse to believe. And remember when we were talking about the holographic paradigm last week, David Bohm said that one of the problems we have with thought is that when we're under pressure, when we need a solution, then almost anything that offers a solution is taken on board in the moment. But because it's a wrong decision, that fairly quickly leads to its own pressure. And that all of this in some way changes the energy field that's feeding our reality, and that as a result our reality changes. And remember, that's your physicist there talking that way. And that's exactly the kind of process that we're seeing enacted here. By making people feel vulnerable and confused, you force them into a state of denial, or they're trained to fall into that or whatever. It's a psychological defense, and it's not quite inevitable, but it's almost inevitable when one's beliefs are challenged at the fundamental level, that denial is what arises. Obviously, at some points, apotheosis arises. At some points, it's enough to absolutely kick a resolution, a realization, a kind of unraveling in the moment. But most of the time, what it leads to is the need to go down the pub and have a pint and hope that it all goes away. Sometimes we shut down entirely, like the lady said, just like a computer. So the other thing is, there's another alternative, as is brought out in the vid there. You can go into denial, that can be the apotheosis, or it can result in a desire to examine the arguments, to actually try and find out what it is that generally underlies the specific things that are acting to disquiet us. And they quoted several people who said, I don't want to know. If this is true, then up will be down and down will be up. Life will never be the same. But life never was the same anyway. Whether individuals realize it or not, it changed about them. And this idea that someone would have talked, then of course up will be down and down will be up. That's what we've all experienced. We know that it's, again, not just this event that's like that, that the whole thing appears to be 180 degrees about from where we thought or had been led to believe that it might be. Also, the idea that someone would have talked. As Guy was pointing out a couple of weeks ago, he said, as the Hillsborough, all of the activities that went on at the Hillsborough Stadium disaster were being covered over and hidden, and things were being rewritten, and everything was becoming rumour and myth. There were 50,000 people, perhaps, wandering around the place knowing it wasn't true. 50,000 people, possibly even more, and that didn't make any difference. The someone would have talked argument is something that I remember thinking myself, well, surely to God they can't be keeping something like that secret. Well, like I say, given the level of planning involved and all of that, and given that after, you know, Hillsborough and things like that, it still doesn't break out, it's a kind of displacement defence, I guess. Something, again, perhaps we're trained to believe it, but it is a natural response, part of denial, justifying the denial that arises. And like the lady said, I refuse to believe is almost certainly evidence that whatever it is you're hearing is not tolerable to your mindset. I must say though, that once you get used to having a bit of your mindset chipped away at, and maybe even some quite large chunks at it, it becomes a lot easier to do and a lot more entertaining really, because it's kind of like a warm feeling inside as you realise that even further points become hollow under close examination. But common to all of these things, common to the feeling of vulnerability and confusion and anxiousness and the denial, the lack of equilibrium, common to all of these things, once again, we come back to the word that we come back to again and again and again. We come back to fear, as is highlighted by almost everybody who's involved in almost anything creative and forward moving, is that the first thing we need to do is get away from the fear. But there's fear, they highlight special sorts of fear, fears of ostracism, fears of alienation, fears of being shunned. All of those are, I guess, perhaps because we're a pack animal, perhaps again because of our social training, unconventional behaviour leads to ostracism, alienation, being shunned, and of course being identified for all sorts of special treatments by the state. So there's many reasons why people do feel fear of that. It's perhaps better to stick with the known than take on the possibility of the unknown. Fear of our lives being inconvenienced. Oh yeah, well, tell me about it. You know, once you start walking away from bank accounts and stone addresses and all that kind of stuff, then inconvenience just doesn't enter into it. Not technically, but of course, wherever there's that kind of vacuum of inconvenience, all sorts of new conveniences arise and eventually whole new ways of doing things. But it is, these realizations are inconvenient, aren't they? Inconvenient is definitely a good word for it, perhaps a little bit understated. People are afraid of being confused is one of the things that they seem to have said most often, but of course what they're actually frightened of is clarity. Confusion is the fundamental state, it appears to me, and to David Bohm, it has to be said. And clarity is maybe what we're starting to get a glimpse of, just a glimpse, as we crawl from the wreckage. So whether it's fear of confusion or clarity is anybody's guess. They're frightened of psychological deterioration. Well, again, it's not recognition of the great going away of buildings being a put-up job by the government that's going to result in your psychological deterioration. It's going to be failure to realise that the vaccinations, medicines, water, food, fizzy drinks and everything are full of stuff that are going to guarantee your psychological deterioration. None of us want to feel helpless and vulnerable. If we're going to reach any sort of resolution, we need the truth.